Greetings, and welcome back to the podcast. This episode, we are joined by Mr. Jamie Hurd, VP of Capital Markets at Tourmaline Oil Corp, a TSX-listed energy company with a market cap of approximately $20 billion. Mr. Hurd has served as the Vice President Capital Markets of Tourmaline Oil since December of 2023. Prior to joining Tourmaline in 2019, Mr. Hurd served as an analyst and investor at Castleton Commodities International, Surveyor Capital, BML Capital Markets, and Barclays. Mr. Hurd holds a Master of Science degree in Business Administration, majoring in Finance from the William E. Simon Graduate School of Business Administration at the University of Rochester, as well as a Bachelor of Commerce degree majoring in Finance and Economics from Carleton University. In addition, he is a CFA designation holder. Among other things, we sat down to discuss sub-$2 natural gas pricing, marketing ingenuity and hedging optionality, and why quality source rock is essential in the energy business. Enjoy. This podcast episode is sponsored by Conate Water Solutions. Do you need cost-effective water sourcing options to supply your next drilling or completions program? Conate Water Solutions is a specialized hydrogeology company focused on water well drilling, testing, and water management services in Western Canada and Texas. Contact info at conatewater.com or check out conatewater.com for more details. This episode is brought to you by the Canadian Gas Association. The Canadian Gas Association represents Canada's natural gas delivery industry, whose members include distribution companies, transmission companies, equipment manufacturers, and other service providers. The Canadian Gas Association members deliver safe, reliable, and affordable natural gas to meet 38% of Canada's energy needs. Visit cga.ca to learn more about Canada's natural gas. This podcast is sponsored by HeadRacingCanada.com. In partnership with four-time Olympian Manny Osborne Parody, HeadRacingCanada.com is now offering free shipping on European factory performance ski gear. By passing brick-and-mortar savings on to customers, HeadRacingCanada.com offers the lowest pricing available in Canada. Check out HeadRacingCanada.com for more info and get your new ski gear for the season. Good morning, Mr. Jamie Hurd. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate your time, and I know the listeners well, too.
Yeah. No, I'm excited to do it.
You've been suggested by more than one guest. So finally, Mr. Jason Landau at Wartaw Capital was the one that connected us, and I'm glad it finally came up.
Yeah, that was a great episode, too. So enjoy listening to that one. And, you know, thank you very much for doing what you've been doing. It's been great to hear, you know, leaders in the city and abroad and peel some pearls of wisdom. That's been where my values come out of it. So, you know, happy to try to share any thoughts I can share on gas or Tourmaline or investing anywhere we want to go.
You're a big skier too.
Yes.
Which was a common theme on a few of the guests. So some common ground.
Yeah. And you're supporting my alma mater skis. I skied Head for years and years. So happy to see the flag being waved there.
For the purposes of today's conversation, I thought we could structure it in maybe two halves. Or one theme, the investor interest in Tourmaline and your thoughts on natural gas, if that works for you.
Yeah.
As a reminder for the listener, you're the VP Capital Markets at Tourmaline Energy or Tourmaline Oil, but what is Tourmaline for anyone that is listening?
Yeah, so Tourmaline is Canada's largest natural gas producer. It was started out of the financial crisis. It's Mike Rose's third business, and it was, you know, fortuitous timing coming out of a great sale at Duvernay Oil, was able to secure capital and move very quickly and grow the business through leaps and bounds over the last 15 years. And now we are not only the largest natural gas producer in Canada by production, but we're one of the largest in the world by cash flow and free cash flow and market capitalization. And that's been through a strategy of not only owning the best resource, but also integrating a midstream business and a sizable marketing platform so we can get our volumes to premium markets and distribute it through, you know, the areas in North America that need it the most, that have the most demand.
To rewind the clock a little bit, how did you get into energy?
So I have some familiar connections with energy. I had uncles and a grandfather in energy. Definitely was interested in university in pursuing finance with an energy lens. And so I found my way into investment banking at Barclays in Calgary and worked under Tim Kitchen and Dominic Odell there. And it was right at the end of the NOC boom where largely Asian NOCs were coming into Canada trying to secure resource. They had kind of a mandate to try to own as much resource as they could globally in an era where the Chinese government was trying to make sure that they had enough supply to satisfy the booming economic growth in their own country. And so it was from school into this bank, very green behind the ears, and learned a ton very, very quickly. This is in the area where in Canada was doing the JVs. So we advised on the Duvernay JV. We had advised on the JV at Cup Anchorage, which still persists today. And it's a shining moment for that one. Because I remember in that JV, it was all about LNG Canada. That's why Mitsubishi was looking for the resource there. So it's really exciting to see LNG Canada finally on the doorstep here. Following Barclays, worked Bank of Montreal in research under Randy Olenberger. Learned a lot about, you know, how different investors see investments in energies different ways. Really enjoyed my time there. Spent a couple of years in the U.S., in New York and Connecticut, working for Citadel under their surveyor banner, again, covering energy from a hedge fund perspective, and definitely honed my own thoughts on how energy stocks can trade and learned a ton and was frankly humbled many times in that space. Lasted 6 years in different venues with Citadel and then later Castleton, but was a huge learning era for me in terms of how investments work in energy and how to invest in energy, especially in that era, 2014 through 2019. It was choppy times, to say the least. And then I've joined Tourmaline here starting in 2019.
Did you ever cross paths with Ken Griffith?
Yes. So I was there during one of their anniversaries. And in the anniversary, Ken was at the party, and that was a wild party, and it was fun to see. Citadel as a platform was an incredible buffet of all you can eat research and access. I was super, super fortunate to be able to look at every single research provider that was offering any kind of data you can think of, whether it be satellite or credit card or flow data. You know, Enverus today was drilling info back then. And along with, you know, the Geoscale Platform Canada and Ross Smith Research here in Calgary. And so it was, in my career, it was a great moment. I had enough knowledge from my banking history to know kind of what I was looking for. And then to have a huge buffet of all the information you could possibly want from Kepler to IRR to Enverus on how to ingest it. And that was one of Citadel's biggest benefits for me. And it was definitely an education in how to run long short at a world-class level. I worked under Tim Schneider there, and he taught me a ton on how positioning and timing and catalysts and sizing works in the long short framework that Citadel employed. And he learned his craft from Steve Cohen at SAC, so now 0.72. So super, again, fortunate to work for him in that context.
Then you ended up at Tourmaline. Were you aware that you were beginning work at an above average energy company?
It took me 6 months to get here. I pounded my way into this firm through emails and coffees and phone calls, sit downs. I was trying to get my way in as best I could. And I'd come back to Calgary. The way Castleton was changing, they were dropping equities out of the portfolio. So I was going to be having to go back out east to manage money. Or if we wanted to stay here, I was going to have to find a job that was appropriate for Calgary. And for me and my family, it was important to stay at that point. And I've been covering Tourmaline for 6 years. And one of the interesting things about this business, Tourmaline, is as you peel back layers, you find additional sleeves of value. In some businesses, as you peel back layers, you find additional sleeves of risk. And so in my experience, I think Tourmaline had some layers of value that weren't on the surface. And that was kind of my pitch to Mike and Brian, was just changing little tweaks on how we're discussing things. And also just to have someone in the firm where you as an investor feel comfortable to pick up the phone and ask a dumb question. It's hard to ask Mike or Brian a dumb question. It can be easy to ask me a dumb question and get just that a little bit of nuance in. And so that was the general approach, is I think I can do some work here that will be helpful. You've got a great thing here. And selfishly, I wanted to be a part of a great business. And I'd been fortunate thus far working for really, really exemplary leaders. You know, at Castleton, Miguel, one of the strongest natural gas traders I've ever seen in my entire life. And now I have the opportunity to work with Mike and Brian. And so that was what the ideal was, but it definitely took some time to get it done.
I'm correct. You were quite instrumental in the Topaz IPO too.
That was kind of project one. I was still earning trust within the firm at that point. Candidly, I had kind of come in 2019 and I had some proving of myself to do and to show where I had competency. I think I was able to play a role, especially in marketing the placements and the IPO. So helping out where I could with Marty and Cherie, bringing that vein of, okay, I think I understand the question the investor's asking, especially when the investor's got a question behind the question. Sometimes investors will ask a question and really they're trying to get at something else. And so I was trying to fill in the gaps for Marty and Cherie as they were drinking through a fire hose. That was COVID. We did an IPO roadshow all virtually, which means there's no phone you can't not reach. I think we did over like hundreds of calls. It felt like, I'm sure Marty has the count, but the roadshow was exhaustive in terms of 3 to 4 weeks of just morning to night calls. And ultimately we got it done in what was still a super, super challenging environment. 2020, we'd gotten the private places behind us and it was still choppy out there. And so to get that one landed, it was the first IPO in quite a while on energy. And I think a great testament to the team to actually bring confidence in the door. And frankly, I think, you know, Mike's influence and presence on both the board of Topaz and also being a part of the origination of Topaz helped a ton, because at the time it was all about trust. You needed to have trust in leadership and trust in management that Topaz was going to succeed. And frankly, it did very quickly after that, but it was touch and go for a bit there. There was a lot of, especially US investors who had been burned by the MLPs in the decade prior that were super jaded on investing in energy, especially new energy.
Well, that's a bit of an intro and how we ended up here, but to get into natural gas, maybe if you want, the nuts and bolts. Pricing. We're below $2 as of this week.
Below $1.70 today.
So not ideal for natural gas, but what are your thoughts on that? Do you see the price staying where it is? What should investors be watching for in this environment from your perspective?
Gas is going to be volatile, and it has been volatile. I think it's helpful to paint a picture of how we get to below $1.70 here today. Storage is a found asset, and we've been growing in this continent production and demand pretty steadily for the last several decades. We have not really grown storage. And so when you go from a period of high demand, which we had 2 years behind us, you set in wheels, in motion wheels of supply. So you had producers stand up activity, you had producers able to hedge a couple years of forward strips and secure some cash flows. And you saw a huge response from tier two and tier three basins, especially private operators who brought back gas in basins that we haven't really seen growth before. We saw growth in the Piceance and the Barnett. We saw growth in the Rockies for the first time in 5 years. We saw Eagle Ford growth peak up, SCOOP/STACK growth peak up. It kind of came from everywhere. And it was needed because, rewind 2 years ago, coming out of COVID, we had a high stress of demand. LNG export capacity was sorely needed. Europe needed the gas, and we needed the gas domestically. Move forward today, we're coming through a pretty bearish winter. And frankly, last year's winter was bearish as well. And operators had been positioned for the next big boom. The next big boom being the LNG buildout in 25 and 26. The struggle the market has is, despite production and demand growing, storage is still relatively the same as where it was before. Call it a 4.2 to 4.3 TCF cap, which in today's numbers is 30 to 40 days of storage in any given moment. That's not very much. And so price is having to do a lot more work. And as we've kind of patterned through this winter and it's been soft, and the fall ramp in production as we got Permian Highway on and some of the Haynesville connecting pipes on was probably 1 or 2 billion cubic feet per day higher than we had anticipated. All of a sudden, supply is a little hot and you've lost what could have been meaningful demand. If on normal winter relative to today's winter would be, 400, 500, 600 billion cubic feet a day of demand drawn that we haven't seen drawn out. And so now we're trying to balance to make sure we don't overfill this year, and we're doing it with price. So today at below $1.70, what the market is trying to sniff out is economic curtailment. And it's been heightened most recently because you've had some LNG's trips in the Gulf Coast. So Freeport's lost a train. Sabine had a couple weeks of issue. The pivot is probably really soon. I think you saw even today's NOMs out of Appalachia were down 700 million a day. Tuesday's usually a noisy number, so we have to see a couple of days of persistence. We see several of Tourmaline's U.S. peers report earnings and their outlook for 2024. I would anticipate some of them to probably have some sort of plan for economic curtailment or curtailment in softer gas prices. So the supply response is going to be happening. We're going to get, you know, Freeport back in a couple of days here. And then the thematic turn this summer goes towards how are we going to answer the fall, winter, and next summer demand picture. And price will navigate higher. The forward strip would indicate that it expects by the fall, not only are we above two, we're probably above three. And frankly, when you look at past years of bearishness, every year where we have slipped below $2, 6 to 12 months later, we've been over a dollar higher, often over $3. And so price is trying to work the system to curtail supply, so we can balance this summer into the fall. And then by the time you and I are sitting across the table from each other, perhaps in September, we'll be talking about drone sightings on flare stacks and LNG plants, ships coming into market, startup of Golden Pass, Plaquemines, LNG Canada. And I anticipate we're going to be talking about how much power burn we had for yet another summer in a row. That's been the unreported story, is the power burn we've had in North America, particularly the United States, has blown everyone's expectations back. 2 billion cubic feet per day of year-over-year growth. I think we probably have additional year-over-year growth this year, despite coal also being priced to compete. It's just been a big thematic change in power demand and gas power burn, as you have AI, data centers, and frankly, cooling demand surprise to the upside several summers in a row as well. So there's a path here. It's going to be bumpy. It's going to be volatile. LNG capacities will help down the road. LNG capacity gives you access to effectively world storage in a sense. If you have a high price North American market, you'll probably have some LNG export curtailment. Likewise, if you have low floating prices, you know, that'll influence back into the North American market. So you'll link. That'll take a little bit of the volatility out of the system, especially during buildout. But here where we're waiting for LNG buildout today, I think you're going to see some big, big price moves, especially in the weeks to come.
The best cure for low prices is low prices, perhaps. But on the other hand, when you're looking out to the future of natural gas pricing, and this maybe gets into hedging a little bit, how do you protect yourself in the case that you're wrong on the price call? How do you think about that?
I think first and foremost, you have to have an organic supply cost advantage in your business. You need to be operating on assets and with assets that can generate cash flows that are profitable at all parts of the pricing cycle. If you are in a business where you have mid to high cost assets and you're relying on a hedge book to try to cover the troughs, you're one long trough away from a faceplant. And we've seen that before. At Tourmaline, hedging here is done primarily opportunistically. We're trying to add value to the quote. We want to improve our price realizations. There's not a dividend that we're trying to protect. There's not a maintenance capital program that we're trying to protect. That protection is done by the quality of the assets and the ownership of the midstream business. Tourmaline's assets and midstream business break even under $1.50. And so that's allowing us to compete organically through all parts of the cycle. The hedging program is what supplements revenues over and above that and vends into interesting opportunities on the physical and financial side of marketing, which I'm sure we can get into. The hedging itself is actually, from a market perspective, big picture, an adder of volatility. So, you know, one of the reasons you can see that is when prices were high in 21-22, it allowed operators to add activity and add production. And that production can persist even as the gas quote weakened through 2023, because they're still receiving cash flows off these hedges. They've in their, you know, quickly they're thinking about that 2023 strip as a post-hedge number. Like, okay, I'm still getting high threes, low fours. Drill, baby, drill. Let's go. Even though the organic gas price is sliding and sliding and sliding. So it actually creates a lag effect. It creates a lag effect in the market where operators will generally drill longer into a hedged book. And then once the hedges roll, then they cut back. But it actually exemplifies the whiplash. And that's kind of what we're getting right now.
A few questions from Twitter were, why aren't we cutting rigs? But That would be the answer right there.
That's one of the answers. And frankly, we have cut rigs. Haynesville rigs are down 30 relative to where they were before. Permian rigs are down 30 from where they were before. Overall, gas rigs are definitely down. And oil activity is down as well. Privates, frankly, have done a ton of the work. The private rig fleet is down a lot more than the public rig fleet. But activity is down. It doesn't correlate well with production today because of the lag effect. In the Haynesville, if you're drilling a 4 to 6 well pad, that pad can take 6 to 9 months to drill, complete, tie in, test, and then flow. And so all the capital you spent 9 months ago is now finally flowing back. And in engineering-focused businesses where everyone is driving towards uptime, execution, it's really hard to tell that engineering team, hey, by the way, let's turn that pad off. That's a really hard decision. And those decisions are things that are kind of more strategic. And I think we're going to see them be made right now. You'll probably see some curtailments, probably at the processing level, on just broad basin turnback. But it's those lags. I think we probably do see definitely a moderation in rig activity. You've seen it already in Canada. Some mid-caps up here have already talked about less planned activity than maybe they have been thinking about 3 to 6 months ago. I think that'll be mirrored across the board industry-wide. You know, gas activity will try to position itself more to be putting volumes in 25 relative to trying to hurry them up into 24.
What's different about sub $2 gas now versus in the year, say, 2014?
So in 2014 through 2019, we didn't have a structural demand outlook that showed us a roadmap to higher and higher demand. In 14, we were fighting the exact opposite battle, and it was an associated gas growth battle. In the 14 through 19 era, it was shale 1.0. It was still drill, baby, drill. And Permian, in some years, the associated gas growth of the Permian, 3 to 5 billion cubic feet a day, would satisfy all of North America's demand growth through the whole year. And so a dry gas basin like the Haynesville or Appalachia had no room to participate in any growth that year. And we're getting priced out, frankly, on the marginal economics. Today, we see moderated growth out of the Permian, especially as consolidation continues to roll through. When you look at the privates that have been acquired by the likes of Ovintiv or Diamondback yesterday, and you look at how those privates grew into the acquisition, they definitely grew faster than the pro forma business has been announced it will grow go forward. So that consolidation has slowed the Permian down. And now the Permian, on average, on a year-over-year basis, probably adds 2 to 3 billion cubic feet a day, not 3 to 5 billion cubic feet a day. And we can see those additions come in lockstep with pipe adds. Matterhorn Q4 2024 will be the next big one to watch. Everyone's looking for it. And the gas will precipitate into the Gulf and feed some of the LNG buildout, but it can't satisfy all of it. So today, this $2 quote we see today is from this whiplash supply-demand impact that we've had kind of confluence on us with weather this spring. But in the outlook, we've got this really large LNG buildout of roughly 4 to 5 summer over summer billion cubic feet a day coming out of the Gulf and Canada. And then thereafter, additional adds from the Gulf, Mexico, and potential additional Canadian volumes out to the end of the decade that are going to need dry gas supply coming in on a yearly basis. And the dry gas supply can only really come from the Haynesville, associated Permian and Eagleford, and then Canada, and whatever the SCOOP/STACK and Rockies can assemble outside of their own legacy declines. Appalachia has the MVP window. MVP will be helpful. It will probably tighten basis up a little bit, but their MVP volume participation of the Gulf is modest until additional debottlenecking has occurred. It kind of gets into the Carolinas, Florida panhandle. You don't get much volume into the Gulf Coast. And so the difference between two today is you do have structural demand coming in 6, 12, 18, 24 months that does need dry gas dispatch, and dry gas dispatch needs $3.50, $4 gas. And so you need to create a dynamic where prices float up, allow some growth out of these drier gas basins, particularly the Haynesville, the Montney. And that structural flywheel is very different from what we saw in 14, which is kind of a period of despair. It didn't look obvious that gas is going to have a real home on the demand stack that would balance the market for years.
today versus 2014, you're seeing green shoots, and back then you maybe weren't.
Yeah, I think back then you had a lot of operators pivot from gas to liquids. And that's 2014 was the period where Tourmaline got lean. Like Tourmaline's cost performance 14 through 19 was incredible. Just grinding down on operating costs, capital costs, everywhere you could. And then miraculously, you know, through great leadership, keeping the balance sheet intact at the same time. And so then the business was able to acquire and be on the front foot in 19, 20, 21 when things started to inflect. It's different today. The other thing that's different today is the inventory picture is a much different conversation in 2024 here than it was in 2014. We have real evidence of tiring basins and supply costs rising today, especially in some of the, you know, in the Haynesville, for instance. There's good evidence in the Permian, the Eagleford for sure, where every year it's going to cost these operators a little bit more to get the same amount of BOEs. That also wasn't a part of the picture in 2014.
LNG, rising demand, better egress are all contributing factors to the case for natural gas. But to get back to the start, I guess, why natural gas from Tourmaline's perspective?
Natural gas in Canada provides Tourmaline an opportunity to have the best-in-class asset in North America. There are some select oil assets in Canada that can compete head-to-head with Permian, but they're small and they're discreet, whereas the Montney is a world-class asset. That's an asset that can have as low a supply cost as anything North America can offer in any of the other U.S. basins, inclusive of Appalachia. The best parts of the Montney stack head-to-head. And what Tourmaline has been able to figure out on the marketing side is to bring that world-class asset down into these demand centers at transport costs that are equal to or often less than their U.S. peers. And so if we can bring Montney gas into the Gulf, our initial Cheniere contract, the transport cost on that is 86 cents. You know, that's moving 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 kilometers, depending on where we're sourcing it, Deep Basin or Montney. And we're competing head to head and winning, frankly, on a margin perspective with gas that is sourced there out of the Eagleford or the Haynesville. That's one of the biggest reasons for why gas is just follow the rock first. Mike's a geologist first. Tourmaline's got an extremely strong geologist team headed up by Colin Frostad. And they've been very good at getting access to these windows and putting Tourmaline in a position to develop rock that will compete at any level.
I guess that's a good segue to marketing. Why is Tourmaline so good at marketing? And without giving away your secrets, how?
I think it starts with people. And I think full credit goes to Sharon Aspen and her team. Prior to her, Rick Kroll set up the beginnings of what is now an extensive marketing network. But you know, Cher is making calls that have the business winning every day. I think we've been really, really smart on our LNG strategy, always finding deals that are early in queue, which we think is important. We think it's important to be shipping LNG first, not biggest, and also finding deals where we're happy with the LNG netback at all parts of the LNG price cycle. California has been an incredible boom, and it was not obvious when we started setting up the California projects that a state with an ever-increasing reliance on renewable power and adding solar and adding wind at a subsidized rate. Remember, this is resi solar was heavily subsidized until very recently, that they would have strong natural gas demand. That was not a no-brainer. And so the forethought of getting into those contracts, being able to displace the Rockies gas that used to come in through Ruby, getting down GTN, getting all the way down to Red Rock to PG&E, and now we enjoy roughly a $2 premium to Henry Hub in any given day, and sometimes incredible asymmetric right skew convexity events where California has a weather event, their renewable pack cannot deliver power, and gas just screams up as they run their gas assets as absolutely as hard as they can along with their import assets. Those can be incredible cash flow events, and that was foresight. The second part of enabling that is scale. And so being a big business and owning infrastructure allows for investment grade credit rating and allows for you to come into the open season negotiation with IG credit, large resource, and a business of scale that the pipeline company can trust to allocate 20 years of business towards. We're making 15 to 20 year agreements with, you know, counterparties in all theaters, but the midstream companies and the LNG companies, and they have to, you know, trust that we're going to be around in 15 and 20 years in good financial condition in order to, you know, have that transaction take place. And that's definitely been something that was a huge advantage through to 2022. And it remains an incredible advantage today, particularly in the LNG negotiations. You've seen only a handful of operators able to sign LNG commitments, and still very, very few today are able to ship today. And yet there's all these US operators that are trying to be LNG ready and trying to have gas facing LNG, but without the credit worthiness, they're having to bring in trading partners through HOAs and then use their credit in order to facilitate the access to the plant. That's just added cost that chews up your margin. So that credit worthiness and respecting the balance sheet and having size and scale has been a massive tool.
This may be too simplistic, but optionality. The hedge book allows Tourmaline to lock in prices in the future and take away the risk. But how do you think of it from keeping yourself open to the massive price swings in the event that they do happen? How do you approach that aspect of the business?
Yeah, so if you look at our hedge book in detail, typically we are securing away what can be an oversupplied market dynamic. And so for us, we're in a producing market of the AECO Basin. So our hedge book largely is satisfying our exposure to AECOs, particularly in the months where AECO can be weak. Now, structurally, AECO's really improved. TC's debottlenecked the system. They completed their $9 billion expansion, and CGL will further debottleneck it for years to come. But still, as a producing region, you want to be able to secure away pockets of the year where AECO can be weak. We don't typically heavily hedge your destination markets that have that right skew asymmetry. So we're not going to be hedging Chicago winter in the summer, because that Chicago winter can print very, very, very strong gas prices. Likewise, in California, we don't heavily hedge those tenors because of that right skew convexity. But you can only get that right skew if it's a demand pull market. It has to be a market where from time to time, through instances of weather or happenstance, you have demand outweigh supply, and the price reaction can lurch towards you. And so part of it is like making sure physically you have access there. You don't want to be making a financial bet into a market where you don't have physical access. And so marketing comes first, and then the hedge book optionality is always trying to seek out as much right tail convexity as you can. And those will continue to be strong cash flow events that frankly are unforecastable really. And they're never in the forward strip. They're never really show up in forward premium. You know, California trades $2 over hub because that's the toll math. That's what it costs a marginal molecule from Texas to try to work all the way around. But it's not going to reflect that weather premium, because that weather premium is only going to be enjoyed by the physical molecule. It doesn't get enjoyed by the prompt rolling financial contract. It's kind of something that happens in cash.
How do you explain the fact that you're convex to optionality in the natural gas market to investors, that you are able to capture the black swan? Is it easier? How do you do that?
I would say more than half of my conversations, modeling conversations and investor relations, revolve around realizations. Realizations in Tourmaline's business are the most interesting, but also potentially the more complex part of the model. And I think we walk through working examples. There's times in history where we can show them when PG&E spikes that in the following quarter, we did financially capture the majority of that spike. I've tried to create small examples in Excel, or basically unpacks of our financial statements, that allow them to use what's all publicly available information, but organize it in a way that a model would be able to ingest it. And then with a couple steps on their own, they can go through the steps of forecasting it. It is something that I think we put a lot of effort into, and something that your average non-energy specialist investor does have to take on, at least on their first step, with a bit of trust, because the complexity is such that it isn't easily found in other sectors of the market. So they don't typically have a great analog. And so it's something like, okay, here's a source of volatility in the system, and then they have to decide for themselves, is this source of volatility a greater opportunity or a greater risk? And they have to kind of look through our historical patterns of getting through these moments and understand, okay, is this a pro column, or does this go in the pro column or the con column?
The problem is sometimes there's a lot of eyes on the market, and the difference is knowing when the market knows what you know to make the call and when to truly make a independent call. For instance, in the case of Middle East, sometimes people call for higher oil prices, but everybody knows that already. It's in anticipation of higher oil prices in the Middle East. And so it's the wrong call. How do you differentiate the times when you think everybody else is making the same call and making independent decisions? Is that difficult?
No, it's a good question. I'll frame it this way. So in oil right now, there is an anticipation that when we have a global economy running at a normalized level, we will be tight. We haven't yet had a period where we've seen that stride out. And loomingly in oil, there is spare capacity in the Middle East. There's barrels waiting. There's production that isn't online that can easily be online with low switching cost. That's a dampener on price psychologically. If you know that a price response could, even if everyone agrees that they don't want to and OPEC agrees that they want to hold the line, if it could be answered by supply, that's something that weighs on price. And frankly, shale's growth last year adds a fly into that ointment. It's hard. My view is that shale growth this year on the oil side is not robust. It's probably in the 200, 300, maybe 400 million or 400,000 barrels a day range. So 0.4 million barrels a day, well shy of where it was last year. But I think everyone's watching because last year was a pretty banner year. And when Exxon and Chevron have very strong Permian growth, that, you know, adds to the conversation. Okay, what are we actually going to get out of here? So in there, the expectation is that, all right, we should be tight in a good demand market. But we have some of these factors, you know, a sleepy China growth story that maybe are weighing us down a little bit. In gas, I would say it's a bit flipped. Everyone expects prices to be stronger next year. That's super consensus. And actually, it's so consensus, it can make you nervous. Like, okay, I'm owning Tourmaline now because I'm bullish on 24, 25, 26 gas prices, more 25, 26. But everyone I talk to is talking about this. Everything I read is talking about this. Is this already priced in? And I would say in gas, it's not priced into the quote. And the reason why is if 25 gas prices were $4.50 today, well, a gas operator could take a 25 swap and a balance of 24 swap and blend them together. And so they could say, okay, I can sell forward gas in 24 at $2.50, sell forward gas in 25 at $4.50, net net. I'm doing just great. That's a price I can drill at. That's a price I can add supply at. The strip knows that. The strip is pricing 25 purposefully low in the 350s today, because if it bids up, a producer is going to hedge it and blend a swap across two annums and add volume to the market exactly when it doesn't need it today. And so as we work through 24, as we solve this spring through curtailment and additional demand through power burn, and we march through this year where a 25 hedge is now accessing a capital increase in the third or fourth quarter of 24. Well, that gas doesn't actually get on until the third or fourth quarter of 25. Okay, maybe that's now too late and 25 prices lift. And our observation is that natural gas equities typically generally follow the valuations imputed by forward strip. And so you can see just when gas prices cross below two, we know that 6 and 9 and 12 months later, they're almost always over 3 and 4, or at least over 3, 6 to 9 months later. We also know that if you buy a gas business when gas is below two, you're almost always, or at least in the last decade, you've always been ahead. Never say never, but you've always been ahead 12 months later. And I think that'll be the function here is right now we're watching for curtailment. We're watching for LNG maintenance and LNG hiccups. This spring will be sloppy. And then when we get to the summer, thematically, we're going to be watching for LNG startup. And I think we'll start to see the productivity degradation and the productivity roll from lower intensities that we kind of put into place 6, 9 months ago. Those rigs we dropped 6, 9 months ago will start influencing the amount of production that can be added this fall, and it'll start to look tight. And because we just only have 30 to 40 days of gas storage, we can go from a market that looks quite loose to quite tight quite quickly, 25 strip lifts, and I think the equities start to follow that story again.
Before we get into M&A, maybe a few thoughts on LNG. LNG is good for the overall economy, but what does that mean for producers? Some people would worry that although it raises the tide for everybody, the nature of supply and demand will reduce the price eventually. How do you think about LNG and kind of a commodity like business?
I think in the mid and long term, we will see supply meet demand. And it'll take a couple of years here. We're going to grow LNG so quickly that it will be hard to match the growth in exports along with a robust domestic gas burn picture in lockstep. We're going to have some years where price will need to price out gas burn. I think when we see price go into the $4 and $5 region, we'll see coal burn come back a little bit where it hasn't been retired. Gas been thin a little bit and domestically, and you're going to have a signal for producers to produce more. The biggest win for LNG, I think, will be those who have assets that aren't experiencing margin degradation through productivity degradation. And what I mean by that is we see in some of these basins that are getting tired that every year they drill a well and it produce 5% less for the same capital. Well, that means that your free cash flow margins drop by roughly 5%. And when you stack that up over time, especially when you sprinkle a little inflation on top, where you were before, were going to be making money hand over fist at $4. Now, all of a sudden, you kind of need $4 just to have free cash break even in some of these plays. And so the opportunity exists for producers who have resource depth in low supply cost markets. And we see that in the Montney. We definitely see that in the Deep Basin still. We do see that in the Permian. The Haynesville is getting on the bubble. And Appalachia probably has also about a decade left. And so I think when you're choosing an investment or you're thinking about which gas businesses are going to have the biggest margin uplift, you got to make sure you have resource duration. And then it's how does each market connect in? So in Canada, as LNG Canada starts up, our thesis is that AECO basis does tighten somewhat. We evacuate gas off the West Coast. You have an additional 2 billion cubic feet a day of capacity on the NGTL system. And the LNG Canada partners have already grown the supply for the most part of the gas they're going to need next year. So you're going to have an evacuation that's going to result in a deficit coming into the NGTL market and ultimately less exports east. And that mechanism of how do you export less east? You export less east with slightly tighter basis. And we think that basis can be kind of 50 cents, 75 cents in period, a discount to hub. In periods, you could have flat or premium. We've seen that even without LNG Canada on. And those periods could be more persistent or happen more frequently. But in general, it is on average likely to be a 25 to 50 cent improvement in basis. That does help an operator in Canada, an operator, with assets that have those low supply costs. But it's not a panacea. And it's not a huge change that allows a big CBM boom or something like that. So we don't think we're going to see a huge supply change response. And we would look actually at the year ago supply adds as a good analog. We had $6 gas locally. Many gas plants were not full yet. We had operators who had been in decline and had relatively low decline rates in their businesses. Then it was like, game on, spend money, let's grow. And on average for the year, we only averaged 500 million cubic feet a day of growth. If that's our high end, if a big year for the basin is 500 million a day, that means that LNG Canada is going to take 4 years to backfill. And I think when we look at this, the infrastructure that's in place today, the plants that need to be built, and the capacity from both a drilling and processing perspective, 500 million a day feels to us like a good high end for basin growth. And this year we'll definitely do well shy of that. So we don't think the supply response balances the market in the short term. We actually think it probably takes to the end of the decade to accomplish it. And by the end of the decade, you could add additional native demand through either LNG Canada Phase 2, new pipeline egress. And frankly, in our view, Montney gas will be a big, big story of a Gulf Coast demand buildout as they build out that LNG and realize tiring basins need to be supplemented with Canadian gas. I think that's going to be the 2030 story, is the re-exporting of Canadian gas to the Gulf Coast.
The recent moratorium on LNG development in the States, does that present an opportunity for Canada, or is the pie big enough for everybody regardless?
It was great to see Jonathan Wilkinson come out pretty positively and say exactly that. The moratorium was an opportunity for Canada. Federally, we've had messages sometimes that are not as constructive on LNG. And more recently, we've had messages that are more constructive on LNG. We're looking at Article 6 as a way of thinking about our own emissions. LNG is probably the best way to have carbon trading from one jurisdiction to another. So it's good to see many Fed messages lately on the pro stance on our ability to, move gas out of the continent and help others decarbonize their own economy. Personal, not a trembling opinion, personal opinion, the LNG pause announcement probably was political and probably not a persistent policy. And I've read and I trust in analysis that has echoed the same. So we probably get it in either administration. We probably get FIDs back on the table as early as November or December. And I think you've seen operators wisely show, you know, CP2, the Venture Global project that's kind of most on the bubble with this ruling, signed up a European demand contract just a week after the LNG pause was announced. And I think that's them showing that, no, the world does still need this gas in order to accomplish the decarbonization that everyone's trying to get done.
M&A. Do you see Canadian M&A picking up? I know you can't talk about it in terms of Tourmaline, but which maybe overall, do you see the American trend coming up to Canada in its own way?
In general, yes. And I think actually, if you look back on a decade look back, we have had quite a few consolidation events in Canada. We just haven't matched the veracity and pace of the Americans. And that has really stretched in the last 2 years. The deal activity since last summer to now, especially on the large side in US, has been unprecedented. We've seen a massive, massive amount of consolidation to get a couple over $20 billion deals done in 6 months of each other is very, very rare. I don't think that's near term for Canada, but I do think consolidation will continue in Canada. And you've actually seen it in the mid-cap space with some of our peers. You know, one of our peers, Peyto, was able to acquire the Canadian Repsol assets. Transformative. Changes the whole story for that business. They're drilling great rock now. They've got a totally refreshed deep basin asset. They're doing great things with it. And it raises their bar of relevance for their own shareholders, you know. And I think in general, you have seen that the size and scale and for relevancy in terms of potential ownership of institutional investors has crept up over time. And I don't have a magic number. Like maybe it's 5 billion, 10 billion, or maybe it's over 100,000 BOEs a day here or there. But in general, we know it's going higher. And it makes sense because of all the advantages we were talking about earlier that scale can provide on marketing. But what we didn't really touch on is what scale can provide on the other aspects of your business, like drilling and completions, operating costs, G&A synergies. All those things add margin for shareholders and position your whole business into an area where you can actually add a return through cycle instead of just the top of cycle. So I think that's inherent and that'll occur. What we've observed in Tourmaline is, ahead of consolidation happening around us, we've observed the Americans understand the opportunity in Canada. And so one of the things that we always get asked is, will the Americans come back? They've come back into our ownership. Our ownership is now more than half American. That was not the case when I joined in 2019. It was roughly a third. So the Americans are in the stock and they're in our peers. We see that as well. And then the private equity pivot has happened as well. We were buying private equity businesses in 2020 and 2021. They were kind of fire sale exits in some cases. In some cases, it was just a shuffling of portfolio. Now it's hard. Now private equity in the US, I think, understands the resource opportunity up here. We've actually seen American money from a PE context come into the space. New sleeves stood up, or LPs that are, you know, additionally more American in private equity vehicles in town here. And I think that's potentially an early flag that, you know, American consolidation from a public perspective could be behind them.
On the flip side, the best time to do deals is when nobody wants to do them, like when Tourmaline bought Black Swan. Perhaps, like we said, when everybody thinks it's a good time to do a deal, it's not a good time to do a deal. Do you think of it that way?
There's some truth to that. I think that there's a lot of deals that Tourmaline has passed on in the last 2 years, for sure. And many of them have been just, some of them, we have a lot of resource. And so what we've seen in Canada recently is some deals have ascribed a little bit of resource value to the asset. I'm not saying unfairly or overpriced, but just like to buy this asset, you have to have an intention to drill it up pretty quickly. Your development on the asset needs to be accelerated to justify the price you paid. When we have the amount of resource we have today, we don't typically vend that into our scenario. This is going to be something that we stream into the program. It doesn't change our growth rate. We assemble our operating and capital system on top of it, our D&C system on top of it. We wring out more money, usually 20 or 30% more money, but it's not an accelerated development. And so those assets and those transactions will pass us by. And that's fine because we have the resource we need. Where we've been able to execute and get things done is when something is so obviously a bolt-on and where we can really imprint a operating model that will truly make more money on the asset, like Bonavista. Bonavista is not a ramp case. That asset actually grows very modestly in the years to come in our eyes, but it's going to make a lot of money for us. And it's going to be great inventory that streams right into our program and competes for capital in the Deep Basin. So it's deals like that that we're going to get done. In 2020 and 2021, we got a ton done.
That was the best
in 2 years.
Yeah.
8 deals, just shy of $3 billion. It was an incredible time to be trying to transact and an incredibly exciting time. I think today it is a very, very strategic time. And it's a time where only some things are going to fit here and there. And we have our eyes open. We've kind of got our criteria. It needs to be synergistic, needs to be free cash accretive on an EV basis, not just per share, but EV. It's got to be improving the business and improving our ability to return capital. And we need to be able to bring this in, bolt it on, and have it stream in.
To get back to the Americans, do you see the big fish coming up north for a snack? How are you looking at that way?
We think there's probably been some tire kicks, and we have some peers here who have international footprints, like Conoco's a big presence in BC. They have assets all over the world, and they take time out of their day and their investor days to talk about their Montney. And I think they're really proud of what they have in their Montney. You know, the Murphy Tupgrass, I'd say, would be some of the what they find to be some of the most exciting assets that they have in development. And we would agree that that Tupper asset is incredible. We have assets adjacent to us to it at Sundown and Sunrise. And I think Canada as a jurisdiction is, it can be a little scary at first step. We've got a federal government that is not always supportive of the industry. We've got complicated and sometimes cumbersome regulation. And transportation is a real trump card up here. You need to have ways to move product. And that's a labyrinth that can be intimidating for someone to come in. And then blanket on top of that, there is a history of companies coming in, trying to figure things out here and not all succeeding. You know, we have had exits in times, mostly on the oil side. So I think that gives some operators some pause. But when you look at the US and you look at the basins, okay, who's the best Delaware company to buy? It was Concho 3 years ago. Who's the best Midland company to buy? It was probably Pioneer last year. When you look at the gems in each basin, they've actually been snapped up. So you've got the largest independent now at Diamondback that has a great resource and potentially could be feedstock for a major down the road. Like, that's possible. But there's not that many opportunities to own best-in-class rock. And if you believe in our recipe that best-in-class rock is the start of all great strategy in E&P, you probably will have to start looking at Canada.
Yeah. Dividends versus buybacks. Mr. Mike Rose has basically initiated his own buyback program at Tourmaline, but from a corporate perspective, the company's leaning towards dividends. I guess the question is why?
No, that's a good question and something we reflect on a lot. And in different times of the year, we talk about it more than others. Maybe I'll ask you right off the bat, are you a Tourmaline shareholder?
No, I had some Topaz.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, do you like Dividend Day?
I love dividends.
And I think that's echoed. I think our owners love Dividend Day. They love the base Dividend Day. They love the special Dividend Day. And there's a door opener there. There's a bird in hand is worth two in the bush aspect to that, that actually satisfies a huge part of assets under management in North America. When you look at the pools of capital in the ecosystem, there's a good chunk that needs to satisfy some sort of income component. And no, there's a select-in effect here. But when you look at Tourmaline's 20 to 30 largest owners, many of them are allowing us to participate in those sleeves of capital that they have aligned up with dividend-paying sleeves. Our largest shareholders are typically managing funds, often for retirees that want income. And so we check that box for them. And I think what's unique about Tourmaline is we can continue to offer base and special dividends through cycle. If it was something that we could only do at the top of the cycle and we couldn't persist it, I don't think it'd be as powerful. And this is where it kind of gets away from what's your personal opinion from special dividends to what's the research say. The research says that in general, the strongest signal of a strong business is a dividend. It's the base dividend. The base dividend is one of the best correlators for value, is a good correlator for EPS growth. If you can grow your base dividend and sustain it and not cut it, that's a great correlator for strong underlying business fundamentals. We have volatility in our business lines. We have volatility in our commodity prices. So we supplement our base dividend with a special dividend. We've offered 9 now, and we're going to do another 4 more this year. So that'll be 13. And we're going to show the market how the special dividend can oscillate through a price cycle. The come to appreciate better what high price special dividends can look like and what low price special dividends look like. And I think what they'll come to appreciate is low price special dividends are not zero. We can still do it. And that's what the math says in the margins, is we're still able to offer the special dividend through even sub $2 gas prices. And that will start to garner, you know, more trust in the business. And we think lead to, over time, a premium valuation. And you do see that in general, in correlations, that special dividends and base dividends do better correlate with valuations. And valuation is your cost of capital. If you have a good cost of capital, it opens up lots of opportunities down the road for you as well. So the last thing I would say is, in the debate of buybacks versus specials, we are unique in having been so consistent. And many companies couldn't be so consistent because they would have to abandon the special when prices got lean. And then other companies have chosen to be, you know, more forthright on the buyback. And we've been unique to be special, and that uniqueness, I think, is an advantage. If you're looking for an income vehicle in energy, look at Tourmaline. You know, there's very, very few peers that can match our income plus growth model. And frankly, in a high interest rate environment in energy, typically income houses would have to look to pipelines. And pipelines have a lot of leverage. They do. They carry a lot of debt. And that debt is now being reset at ever more higher interest rates, which puts the dividend under pressure and has caused, in our views, you know, some large pipeline companies and midstream companies to have to make some tough decisions over time. And we think that those could continue to come. So if you want income growth and no leverage, well, now we're really unique. We're energy. We allow you to grab the, you know, the thematics of an improving and bolstered natural gas story. You've got our growth, and now you've got income on top of it without any leverage headaches. We think that could be a slam dunk.
Perhaps one way to summarize it is bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. It also doesn't hurt when your CEO is buying back lots of shares in the market. It's a good signal.
That's right. And many insiders are buying back stock with their special dividends. And I would also say that we have an NCIB in place. The door is open there. And if a stock is ever very dislocated, we will be pragmatic. We will buy back shares. We have before. We bought back shares modestly in the 2020 and 2019 price slump. So the avenue is there, but we think there is value in being persistent and repeatable and predicted. And I think if you can better predict the base and special offering through cycle and get a sense of like, okay, I know what lows and highs are, well, then it'll start to come into the capitalization of the stock.
And maybe this is too simplistic, but as interest rates head downwards, do you view that as a positive aspect for the dividend model?
It makes us more unique. So right now, I would say in dividends, you are competing with a debt instrument. And so if you're able to grab a Canadian GIC in the fives, okay, well, any dividend investment I make has to give me a risk-reward return that competes with that five. We've been able to generally overwhelm that because we have the growth and our yields have been actually, you know, plentiful, high single digits to low double digits on average. So we think we grab that hurdle. And frankly, the interest rates for us put pressure on the potential substitutes to our stock. So there's a mix there where if rates come down, other alternatives will kind of have a bit of a breath, where right now they're definitely under high pressure, but it is an aspect for sure. As interest rates come down, our dividend and our yield and our income becomes ever more unique. And I think it opens up more AUM that says, okay, I need to try to grab a 4% hurdle here. I need to try to grab a 3% hurdle. If I bring in some Tourmaline, that gives me a 3X on my objective. And that could be super helpful. And you bring that in with some sleepy blue chips that are kind of doing the twos and threes like banks. And now all of a sudden you have a premium offering.
New York Stock Exchange listing. Some of your peers have listed in the States to try and capture a higher valuation. Does Tourmaline look at that option, or is Canada enough?
Yeah, no, we do look at it. And I think as the business grows, eventually it's an inevitability. We belong on both exchanges at some point. We're one of the few TSX 60 businesses that hasn't. We're going to be doing it very pragmatically. You can charge into a New York Stock Exchange listing and add a bunch of cost into your business through, you know, administration and supporting SOX compliance. We're a lean business and we want to stay lean. So in being SOX compliant, we want to make sure we use all the technological tools and software and checks that we can. It is something that I think we gather over time. Our view is that the New York Stock Exchange listing will add volume to our shares with potential valuation upside. And that we are aware of some owners that struggle to own Tourmaline in a Canadian exchange. But I would say for most of our institutional owners, they can. What it would open up is a large retail base in the United States that probably is somewhat precluded from owning Tourmaline on the Canadian exchange. The reality is, alongside that New York Stock Exchange listing, we need to accomplish the comparative. And the comparative is when an analyst is able to discuss Tourmaline alongside with our main competitors in the United States in the same breath. And right now, in general, in research, most of our analysts are Canadian-centric. And then there's a U.S. analyst that covers the U.S. stocks. You know, Cambine at Scotia would be unique to be able to do the side-by-side comparison. And what we're working on as hard as we can here is to bring in some more U.S. coverage. Because I think once you get that side-by-side, it's actually pretty obvious. Our risk rewards relative to many U.S. investments are pretty outstanding. And I think especially in markets dynamics like this, when volatility is high, you start to see the stress in the system down there and for several entities. And we can kind of, you know, move through these periods pretty seamlessly. So I think that really helps. But we need that case to be made. And so, you know, we've got Peters that has us in a shared comm sheet. We've got Scotia. There's a couple others. That's the parallel effort we need to accomplish.
This may be a better question for the technical team at Tourmaline, but I guess the question is, why unload the Bonavista Duvernay assets?
We don't need resource. We've got a lot of resource. The Bonavista Duvernay is primarily resource. There's very little production associated with the asset currently. It's 2,000 to 3,000 BOEs a day. There are 5 or 6 wells in. The wells look good. And it's going to be a great starter kit for somebody. Someone's going to make a lot of money with the Bonavista Duvernay. It's going to work. It's oily right now, which is right now is good. Good thing to start up with. But it's locations. And we think that someone probably will do a faster development program on that asset than we will. And in a net present value world where you think about cash flows in terms of discount rates per years, they're going to make more money with it than us. And we hope to be compensated for some of that delta. And I think that's one of the openers for some of the things that we can consider when we're thinking about acquisitions is when we don't really need all the locs, when we don't need all the resource, and we can hone in on grinding greater cash flow to the base asset, that could actually create optionality there. You know, the traditional Glock and Deep Basin trends in Bonavista have decades ahead of them. We're already getting some great results out of those assets, and we'll speak to that in the coming months. But that's enough. We don't need another topper on top of that that's very resource oriented.
On that theme, maybe again, better for technical team, but how does Tourmaline balance stacking the warehouse full of widgets, so to speak, with running a cash flowing business today? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I would say in general, in our trends, we own the rock that naturally vends into the infrastructure. It would be very hard to find a situation where, you know, there's a piece of pristine Montney that someone's going to be able to access, integrate, and pay us a dollar for that we can't squeeze out more ourselves. So, you know, that either the drilling fund idea or the selling excess resource idea in most areas of the play actually doesn't work financially. We're a business that is, you know, designed to hone into these areas, exploit them, and probably make as much money, if not the most amount of money you can make on this resource than anybody could. And so it's really hard to do that trade idea. But your point is valid. And that's what takes the pressure off. When prices are strong and some people are doing deals that are expensive, we don't have to. We don't need to secure resource. We can wait for resource to be free. And then when the resource is coming for free, okay, it's free. It's there. And it creates optionality down the road. Let's do the deal on the flowing metrics, on the cash flow metrics, on the ability to wring out the cash flow that justifies the transaction in like a 4 to 5 year window. Most of our deals, in fact, I would pause to say potentially all of our deals pay themselves off with their own free cash flow in 5 to 6 years. And when your payback period on your deal is 5 to 6 years and your payback period on your wells is 3 to 6 months, your conversion rate on being able to provide free cash out to shareholders is just going to be that much higher.
Well, that's thoughts on gas pricing, M&A, supply demand, LNG, dividends versus buybacks, inventory, New York Stock Exchange listings. If you were to maybe leave the investor with a message to wrap things up, what might you tell them?
I would say, I guess maybe one or two things. I would say one of the things that I continue to be humbled by and learn from is when you're thinking about what you're investing in, I would say 10 years ago, coming out of business school, you kind of had this impression that, okay, you know, you've spoken to this in some of your podcasts, okay, efficient market, things should be priced. And I also had an impression that assets in oil and gas were more widget-like, that factories that businesses were all somewhat similar in quality. And so valuations therefore should be somewhat similar. And there was a temptation to buy the low multiple stock in hopes of a reversion to the mean, or buy the high free cash flow stock in hopes to reversion to the mean. And I would say part of my personal education over the last 10 years is learning where these valuations and these yields are hiding something. It's either a risk or an asset quality issue, or a business that struggles to generate much free cash flow and when prices are low, all these different things. And so from an investing perspective, quality and value at the same time, you need to link them. You got to find quality first and then look for the return opportunity that is compelling to you. That's something that I think on an unpack, you can go super deep on, but it's something that I think I see discussed a lot is, oh, X trades at X and Y trades at Y. I'm interested in the cheaper one. Well, you gotta figure out what are potential reasons for those differences. And then lastly, you know, we're talking here in February, mild winter, very, very low prompt gas prices. It has felt like a long 4 months in natural gas. It has felt like quite a few successive weeks of weaker and weaker quote, and then also weaker and weaker equity prices. And I would just say, like, take a step back and do a couple of the historical analogs on, okay, let's pick out a couple years here where things kind of look like we did today. And what was the 6 month look forward? And actually in all cases, it was pretty compelling. And so there's some signposts to watch out for over the next 3 to 6 months. It's going to be the potential curtailment announcements in the weeks ahead from U.S. peers. It's going to be LNG startup announcements in the summer. And frankly, it's going to be production rolling as a result of the activity reductions that were done 6 months ago, and the struggle for that to inflect again this fall. That's when it'll get really exciting, is when prices do strengthen and there's this, again, sleepy and laggish production response on the back of that. That's when you'll start to see things really ratchet up.
Fair enough. Well, and in the meantime, you can collect the nice Tourmaline special dividend.
There you go.
Patient investors out there. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. We can end the formal conversation there. So
thanks very much for having me.
Hello, listeners out there. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Hopefully the episode provided some insights. If you enjoyed the show, check out trose.ca, where more episodes are yet to come. You can also subscribe to the podcast, where your token of support is much appreciated. Until next time, happy coffee drinking.